This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf promises that elections will go ahead early next year and that he will resign as army commander beforehand, but the state of emergency remains in effect. Political prisoners are still in jail, independent media outlets shut down. Amid the political crisis, there is renewed concern about the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons and nuclear materials. The father of Pakistan's bomb, A.Q. Khan, previously provided nuclear technology to North Korea, Iran, and Libya. Now there's worry that one of the several radical Islamic groups in Pakistan might steal an atomic bomb or the components or the plans for one, or that the entire nuclear arsenal might fall into the wrong hands if there's a coup d'etat. Later, on the opinion page, proselytizing for the presidency, but first, what we know about Pakistan's nuclear weapons program, what we don't, and how Pakistan's nuclear status affects U.S. policy. If you have concerns or questions, give us a call. 800-989-8255 is the number. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. David Sanger is Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back on the program, David.
Nice to be back here.
Yesterday, you and William Broad wrote a front-page story that reports that the Bush administration provided $100 million in aid to help secure Pakistan's nuclear weapons since 9/11, a story that also reveals that there's a great deal the United States does not know about the Pakistani arsenal.
That's right. And I think there's far more that we don't know than we do. The program to secure the weapons was based on training Pakistanis about the most basic questions of security, separating fissile material from the weapons themselves, making sure the weapons and the missiles are separated, putting fences and surveillance systems around, and so forth. What we were not able to do, because the Pakistanis wouldn't let us, is get anywhere near the weapons themselves. And this is not unusual. The United States doesn't let foreign countries near its nuclear weapons either. But the result of that is that we don't really know how good the security is around the weapons. And more importantly, we don't know how good the security is in the laboratories where Mr. Khan once ruled and where many of his disciples still work.
And where the materials, the highly enriched uranium that's used as the explosive, in the, where it's manufactured.
It's manufactured and, it's easier, nuclear experts will tell you, to divert some nuclear material while it's being made than it is to actually get a fully constructed weapon. I mean, when you're making nuclear material, the accounting is always a little bit on the dicey side to begin with. Some stuff literally gets stuck in the pipes. Mm-hmm. So there's always some, I think what Walmart might call shrinkage. And so there is more to play with if some of the material got diverted to somebody who shouldn't have their hands on it.
The Pakistanis were also concerned. They didn't want the United States to know how many nuclear weapons they had, where they were exactly, and what kind of material exactly goes into them, what that highly enriched uranium, what its flavor is, because apparently in analysis you can tell the origin of nuclear weapons.
That's right, and I think we probably do know a little bit about the flavor, because during the Khan investigation, it turned out that there was some material that was stuck on equipment that was sold to Libya and sold to Iran. And the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, got to go test that. And there is a pretty extensive library of different countries' nuclear material, each one of which is basically a fingerprint back to that individual country.
There is one other really important aspect to your story, and that is the decision by the Bush administration as to whether or not to provide a system called PAL, that's Permissive Action Links, and that's what that does is enable the people who own a nuclear weapon to turn it off until they want it turned on, and indeed, even if after it's turned on, to turn it off again.
That's right. The PAL system came into effect in the United States after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when people discovered that there were weapons being loaded onto planes that had no real protective system on it. And so, you know, anybody who's been to a good sci-fi movie sees elements of this now because you've got, or a good crisis movie, mm-hmm. there are codes and links and two-man rules and keys and so forth. One school of thought goes that if there's a country that gets weapons, even if they get them illegally, we ought to go share this system, because the only thing worse than an unpredictable state having a weapon is an unpredictable state having an unlocked weapon. The other thinking goes, and this was what won out, that there are legal restrictions here. Pakistan is not a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. If you're not a signatory, U.S. law prohibits how much technology we can, nuclear technology, we can send to a country, almost nothing. And that includes protective technology, oddly enough. So the administration went through the debate, as the Clinton administration had gone through the debate in the late 90s, could Pakistan be given the PAL system? And the answer came back, no.
The Pakistanis also had concerns about it.
They do, because to let us get in and put the system in their weapons, they feared, would also allow us to go in and put a kill switch in the system. You know, the systems you can put in your car where from a remote control you can turn it off if it's stolen?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they believe that there are some in the United States who might go about doing that in the case of Pakistan. And, you know, maybe they're right. Who knows? So they didn't want us near it. They maintained since that time that they have built in the functional equivalent of PALs, that they have their own kind of system. But if so, I don't think we know very much, or at least I wasn't able to find out very much about what it consists of.
Now, we want to get to concerns about the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons and nuclear material, but one more question about this story that came out yesterday. You, in fact, had this story 3 years ago. The New York Times decided to sit on it. Why?
Well, we asked questions of the administration about this program to secure the weapons at the time the program was just getting started. And they came back with a request that we delay publication because to reveal the existence of the program in its early stages might also reveal to those who would like to get their hands on Pakistan's weapons, which would include Al-Qaeda, of course, and the Taliban, and who knows who else,
mm-hmm.
That there were still, in the American view, significant vulnerabilities. We considered this request, and the editors of the Times decided that they would hold back on the story with the understanding from the administration that the decision of when to print is ours, not theirs, and that we would come back and revisit it with them. We did go back and revisit it about 2 weeks ago, soon after the declaration of an emergency by President Musharraf. Since that time, a few things had happened. The Pakistani press had reported elements of the program. They didn't understand its overall parts. But Pakistani officials had described how they had received international help in securing the weapons. There were a few other news stories that described elements of the program, so it was clear to us that it was leaking out. And now that there was the prospect that there could be a turnover in the Pakistani government, and perhaps even a violent turnover, I mean, we don't know how this whole thing's going to play out, there seemed to be a new reason to ask the question, was this program effective? And I think the answer that you get from the story is, we don't know how effective it is because we can't really look into the black box in which it is contained.
Mm. Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us now is Zia Meehan, a physicist, director of the Project on Peace and Security in South Asia at Princeton University. He joins us from a studio at Princeton University. He's a Pakistani citizen. Zia Meehan, nice to have you on the program today.
Oh, thank you.
And should we be concerned about the security of Pakistan's nuclear materials and its nuclear weapons?
I think there's good reason to be concerned about the security of nuclear weapons and materials in Pakistan, but we should be concerned about the security and materials of weapons everywhere. It's not Pakistan by any means that is alone in having these problems, but I think that the story that came in the New York Times this morning certainly raised some critical issues. But I think many of us feel that the present political unrest in Pakistan is not going to add significantly to the concerns of this about security of weapons or materials in Pakistan. The problem is actually, I think, a different one, which is that the black box that surrounds the Pakistani nuclear complex that David Sanger mentioned is not just a black box for people outside Pakistan. It's also a black box for people inside Pakistan. There is no system of checks and balances on the nuclear program inside Pakistan. So the military says, trust us, and nobody has any way of finding out actually what the situation is inside the complex.
There is also the concern that was based on the activities of A.Q. Khan, the father of Pakistan's nuclear bomb, who either on his own, he says, and the Pakistani government says, or perhaps with government permission, a lot of people think, did proliferate materials to many other countries, many other unstable and unfriendly countries to the United States.
Well, that's right. We now know some extent of what A.Q. Khan and his network were up to. But I think that illustrates this question of the lack of a system of checks and balances, because as a major manager of a facility in the nuclear complex, whatever A.Q. Khan said to his employees in his complex, they assumed that that was government policy and just did what they were told. And there was no system whereby anybody could come in and say, hang on, what do you people think you're doing? So Parliament has never had oversight of the nuclear program in Pakistan. There are no watchdog groups or public interest groups that are able to raise concerns. There's no judicial protection for whistleblowers from inside the program. And the free press in Pakistan is free only to the extent that it reports about some issues, but not about nuclear weapons. So even those people that might have been concerned, there was no way for them to raise their concerns about what A.Q. Khan was doing.
Zia Mian, do you know how many nuclear weapons Pakistan has?
Even General Musharraf says that he doesn't know how many nuclear weapons Pakistan has. The best we can do is to use our best estimates of how much nuclear material for weapons Pakistan could have been able to produce, assuming it operated its facilities with a reasonable degree of efficiency. But no one knows how much of that material has been actually turned into the components for weapons and how much is just being set aside as a stockpile for future generations of weapons.
Does anybody really believe that President Musharraf doesn't know how many nuclear weapons he has?
Oh, sure. I think that many leaders in many countries with nuclear weapons are perhaps not the most important thing that they worry about.
We're talking about how secure Pakistan's nuclear weapons are, or are not. More with David Sanger of the New York Times and with Zia Mian in the Project on Peace and Security in South Asia at Princeton in just a moment. We'll also take your calls. If you have questions or concerns about this issue, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a few minutes, we'll get to the opinion page and an argument that if candidates make religion an issue on the campaign trail, they better be able to face their own sins. But right now, though, our focus is on Pakistan, specifically that country's nuclear arsenal. Just over 2 weeks since President Musharraf imposed a state of emergency, how secure is that nuclear stockpile and nuclear materials? Our guests are David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, and Zia Mian, director of the Project on Peace and Security in South Asia at Princeton University. Of course, you're welcome to join us. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. David Sanger, just before the break, we were talking about President Musharraf does or does not know about his nuclear arsenal. You've talked to him about this.
I have. You know, it's interesting. I talked to him, and some of my colleagues talked to him right after our first big investigative pieces on the A.Q. Khan network, which ran starting the beginning of 1994, just before President Musharraf was forced to put Khan under house arrest. At the time, President Musharraf said that he was quite certain that there was no deal of missiles for nuclear material with North Korea, which was one of Khan's customers. And he repeated that in some other interviews. And then when his book came out last year, he announced that, in fact, he had been deceived by Khan and others in the laboratory. And, in fact, there appeared to be continuing deals. And there were transactions that took place that he didn't know about even after Khan had told him that he was out of business in 2001 with other countries. So President Musharraf's ability to know for sure is difficult. And even when our first pieces on Khan came out, I remember a Pakistani government official declaring that the story was a pack of lies. Well, a few weeks later, they arrest Khan and several of his associates and put them in house arrest. So, you know, it's a little bit difficult here getting at ground truth.
Yeah, and it might be absolutely true to say, I don't know exactly how many weapons I have, speaking as President Musharraf. He has to know what his capabilities are in terms of a nuclear counterstrike, for example, against India.
That's right. Now, of course, in any nuclear complex, you've got actual weapons, you've got material that could be turned rapidly into weapons, and you've got material in process. This is true for the United States as well. So coming to a real number for us, the Pakistanis, the Russians, the Chinese, it's always a bit of a moving target. But yeah, he should have a sense of at least the range. The estimates I've seen for Pakistan range from 55 to 115 actual weapons.
Let's get some callers in on the line. 800-989-8255, email talk at npr.org. And let's start with Michael. Michael calling us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hello, Neil.
Hi.
With all due respect to both your guests, I don't think either one of them has a clue as to the clandestine and secret operation that the United States conducts in Pakistan on a daily basis to secure those nuclear weapons. One of the reasons we have let Musharraf get away with so many things and that we didn't go into Pakistan and bomb bin Laden out of his hiding place was because he does allow us certain rights. And one of them is the safeguarding of those nuclear weapons. I get annoyed at the fact that people think our government has become so hamstrung that they're not capable of doing whatever is necessary to secure the United States.
And, Michael, what do you know and how do you know it?
I recently retired from the Defense Intelligence Agency. I've spent at different times nearly 3 years in Pakistan. And Pakistan is not the only place that has nuclear weapons where the United States has an abiding interest in their security.
That's true, but are you suggesting that U.S. personnel have access to Pakistani nuclear weapons?
I'm not at liberty to say that U.S. personnel have access to nuclear weapons. I can tell you that there are U.S. personnel in Pakistan whose sole function is to assist the Pakistani government in the security of their weapons.
David Sanger, is that right?
Well, the program that we described in the Sunday paper describes a program in which there are American personnel assisting the Pakistanis in securing their nuclear weapons. Your caller may well know far more detail than we do. We live as reporters in an unclassified world. He has emerged from a world with access to classified information. I always assume as a reporter in Washington that I know fully 5% of what's going on any given day. That said, having talked to a number of senior officials, they are concerned about what they don't know, what Donald Rumsfeld used to wonderfully refer to as the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, you're suggesting, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but you're suggesting the United States knows a lot more than appeared in the paper yesterday.
Well, without question. And I think something else to keep in mind, the government of the United States wouldn't be very good in its capacity with regard to intelligence if reporters for newspapers and the rest of the media were able to get access to these types of operations. The government has gotten better and better and better at keeping things like this secret.
All right, Michael, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And I wonder, Zia Meehan, your reaction to that. Do you think the United States is deeply involved in protecting Pakistan's nuclear arsenal?
I'm sure the United States would like to be much more deeply involved, but there would certainly be a lot of resistance from within the Pakistani military about what degree of involvement to allow for many of the reasons that David Sanger mentioned earlier. And the two things I think that are important here are that even if the United States were to help Pakistan increase the security of its nuclear materials and that security was much more robust and even met U.S. standards, is that even secure enough? And we've seen just in the last month or so the instance of the six nuclear-armed cruise missiles that were inadvertently loaded onto a U.S. Air Force bomber and flown across the country without anybody knowing for the better part of a day that these nuclear weapons had gone away from where they were supposed to be. Mm. And there are constant reports from inside the U.S. complex, like, for example, Los Alamos National Laboratory, which has been making nuclear weapons for 60 years, about abiding problems with security of the material that is inside those laboratories. And many exercises have shown that people could break into those facilities in the United States and carry away enough material to make nuclear weapons. So even the U.S. hasn't managed to get the security of this complex and these materials safe enough. So the problems that Pakistan faces are just that much greater.
There may not be a safe enough, but anyway, let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Paul. Paul with us in Cleveland.
Well, I just want to say it's a fascinating topic. My question is, the Pakistanis, have they ever followed the lead of the United States in the early Cold War when we had Operation Chrome Dome? We were keeping a portion of our nuclear deterrent airborne on B-52s 24/7 to prevent a nuclear Pearl Harbor. And given the rather up and down relations between Pakistan and India, you know, that have actually even flared into gunfire at times, had the Pakistanis gone the route of dispersing their weapons onto their delivery systems, which would of course make them even more vulnerable to theft and or other things. And let me just say that my credentials, I'm a civilian. I don't have security clearance. However, I have kicked a live nuclear weapon of the U.S. Armed Forces. So, you know, security is a two-way street, and we both have our problems.
Did you say you kicked it?
Kicked it, yes, on board a submarine. I was given a tour, and I tapped a sub rock, and I said, hey, that's a nuke, isn't it? And the guy said, take the tour to the next room, please. And, in fact, it was. But, yeah, I mean, you know, bombs are bombs, and they're all very safe, one would assume.
One hopes. I wonder, Zia Meehan, can you help us out on Paul's question? Is there a ready alert status of Pakistani nuclear weapons response capability?
As far as we know, Pakistan doesn't actually have its nuclear weapons deployed on a 24-hour-a-day, seven-day-a-week basis, unlike the United States and some other nuclear weapon states. It keeps its nuclear weapons separate from its delivery systems and may even be keeping the warheads in components as a way of making sure that the materials and the weapons are safe and secure and actually under some kind of control system. And this is actually one of the most important elements, I think, that's been missing from this conversation. As David Sanger mentioned, that in the United States, there is concern about the legal implications of the United States sharing this coded switch technology, the permissive action links that might make the weapons more secure. And the Pakistanis are concerned about the U.S. getting access to its weapons. But the third element that we need to keep in this discussion is that if Pakistan had this permissive action link technology, it would feel much more comfortable assembling its weapons and putting them on missiles and putting them on airplanes, because the leadership would think, now we have reliable, guaranteed control over our weapons, so we can put them on alert and keep them ready to use whenever we want. And that's something I don't think we should encourage.
Hmm. Paul, thanks very much for the question, and remind me not to let you kick things in my house. Thanks, Paul, and let's see if we can go now to, this is, excuse me, button four, Chuck in San Francisco.
Hi, thanks a lot.
Sure.
The Pakistani military and the intelligence service had a relationship with the Taliban, and the Taliban had a relationship with Al-Qaeda. So my question is, what do we know about the relationship between the people that have these materials and the people we really don't want to get these materials?
David Sanger.
Well, that is the centerpiece. It's a very good question. It's the centerpiece of the concern about the laboratories. Right after 9/11, there was considerable evidence that came out that two officials, scientific officials of the Khan Laboratories, had gone up and met with Osama bin Laden before 9/11, and that bin Laden had expressed an interest in nuclear weapons, and they had described to him, you know, the difficulties of this. These people were put under arrest ultimately by the Pakistanis. They have since been released. But within the ISI, there is
the Pakistani
Security Service. There is considerable Taliban sympathy. It appeared at the time of the Khan investigation that within the Khan laboratories there were some of those sympathies as well. Khan himself seemed to operate more with an interest of becoming a multimillionaire and maybe ultimately one day the president of Pakistan than he was interested in supporting the Taliban. But because we have so little visibility into the labs, we don't really have a sense of how well they have figured out the loyalties of all those who worked there.
Another question?
Is that a question, Chuck?
I was wondering also if you guys could. There's a lot of talk about political developments in Pakistan. If we were to promote a more functioning democracy there, what do you think the chances of the government being one that we would like versus one that we would have real problems with is?
Well, let me ask Zia Meehan that in his capacity as a Pakistani citizen.
I think that if the past political development of Pakistan is anything to go by, if there were to be free and fair elections and not under the kind of emergency that General Musharraf is managing right now, there's very little likelihood that the Islamist parties would emerge with anywhere close to a significant representation in parliament. The only reason that they've done so well in terms of the number of seats they have in the current parliament is because General Musharraf made sure that the mainstream parties in Pakistan were not able to compete fairly in the last election. So by making sure that the elections are free and fair, the Islamic parties would go back to their traditional share of the vote, which is very small. But, and this is the big but, that across Pakistan, there is a generational process unfolding where more and more people are turning to Islam as a source of identity and of a way to articulate a general sense of dissatisfaction with the failure of the country to deliver basic goods and services, jobs, health, housing, education, etc. And by turning to religion, they feel that somehow there is some solace and some possibility. And as that trend continues, unless the government of Pakistan really gets to grips with basic development questions, there will be more and more people that see their loyalty and their identity as Islamic rather than Pakistani. And then that will spread into the labs and into the military even further than it's gone. And so we need to think about this in the longer term rather than the shorter term.
Chuck, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking with physicist Zia Meehan and with David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller in. This is Abdul. Abdul with us from Fremont in California.
Hi. I have got a little bit of comments and also a question. Comments was Pakistani military, the ISI. They were the people who trained the suicidal bomber and to go into Afghanistan and unstable Afghanistan. Exactly what they did, and that was successful in their one. And what happened, they came to them, and they were like, those Taliban, they came back to Pakistan and they start those suicides in Pakistan. And now they know that they did a bad, and there was another good choice to do with it. The other thing was that we, as Americans, shouldn't trust General Pervez Musharraf because he promises with his country that he'll respect the Supreme Court, he'll the elections, all those promises, and he didn't deliver nothing. The other thing is that my question from Zia Meehan that we all know in a military, two, three functions, there are different parts. The Taliban, there are some people there who support Taliban, people of Nawaz Sharif, maybe people of Pervez Musharraf. What if they split? How going to be this nuclear, how much the nuclear will be safe?
Mm-hmm. If there's a split in Pakistan's military, different factions, as caller Abdul suggests, does that compromise security of the nuclear weapons, do you think, Zia Meehan?
If it reaches a severe polarization, sure, in the long term, but there's no signs that we're anywhere near that kind of polarization within Pakistani society or within the military by any means. What we see out on the street is human rights workers and lawyers and teachers and doctors and students protesting for democracy. They're not the kind of people that want to get access to nuclear weapons or trigger a crisis within the military and a civil war. Mm. What they want to do is to restore the rule of law. And so I think these are not the kinds of things we need to worry about.
David,
what we really need to grapple with, I think, is that
quickly,
as Pakistan's nuclear program expands in response to its concerns about the expansion of India's nuclear program, this problem will get worse, not better.
David Sanger, just a few seconds left. Is the Bush administration seriously concerned about the security of these weapons and these materials, and perhaps that whoever succeeds, General Musharraf, might not be somebody who they entirely trust?
I have to assume they are, because in the course of reporting out the story that appeared in the Sunday paper, we learned that there were two very recent intelligence reports that were briefed all the way up to the president about the security of the weapons. And those intelligence reports were the basis for Admiral Mullins, the head of the Joint Chiefs, declaring on Thursday that they believe the laboratories and the weapons themselves were safe for now. And that was an interesting qualifier they put on it.
David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times, co-author with William Broad of yesterday's front page story. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Neil.
Zia Meehan was also with us, director of the Project on Peace and Security in South Asia at Princeton, with us from the campus at Princeton University. Thanks very much for your time today, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up, closing the so-called God gap on the campaign trail, but refusing to own up to your own sins. The opinion page is next. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.